With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, it's a big boost for the Delta Mendota Canal Floating Solar Project. Find out how much funding the project is getting. But we start today with Brian German.
We're here again this morning with Director of Education and Communications with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, Anna Genasi. And today we're talking about an event you folks are hosting in a couple weeks. The annual meeting is coming up soon, and it seems like you've got a pretty interesting speaker for this year's event.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. So this year is our 110th annual meeting of members, and we're really excited to share that Amber Lee Snyder will be our guest speaker. If you don't know Amber Lee's story, she was a fantastic winning barrel racer who unfortunately was in a terrible accident that rendered her paralyzed from the waist down. And her story is really about overcoming those obstacles that life puts in your path. And she is now back on the horse and barrel racing once again, in fact, winning, even though she, you know, continues to not have use of her legs. And we just thought her story was really timely. You know, the ag community is up against some really tough things right now between, you know, pricing and trade and the cost of inputs and the new regulations. And so we thought having somebody come in who can talk about having a success even when life, it feels like life kind of knocked you down.
And it's cool because a lot of speakers at these types of events are, you know, general business leaders or maybe sports icons or something like that. But to get someone who's involved in and around this community, it's kind of neat in and of itself.
Yeah, she's kind of a legacy in the Western world. In fact, she has a movie about her life on Netflix called Walk, Ride, Rodeo. And I, you know, typically we're very blessed. Our annual meeting is well attended every year. We usually have around 400 people. This year, we're actually planning for closer to 700. We feel like folks are going to be coming to see Amber Lee as much as they're coming to celebrate with us. So
that's cool. And so definitely prepping for a packed house there. And now, aside from hearing her story, what other reasons might people have to come out to this year's event?
Yeah, so it's, you know, a meeting of members, but you actually don't have to be a member to come. Of course, we encourage you to join as a member. But our night includes a great meal, an open bar, a great trade show. Obviously, Amber Lee will be there speaking, but you'll also hear from some of our local leadership. So our outgoing president will kind of give his farewell, will acknowledge the incoming president. It's just a really great night. It's fun. There's fellowship, good food, and we can plan on a fantastic speaker.
So a good opportunity to network and hear from industry members and the like. And now, when is this going to be taking place and how might people be able to get signed up to attend?
Yeah, so Thursday, April 25th is the day of the event. So we're about 3 weeks out. It's going to be held at the Turlock Fairgrounds. Tickets are only $65 a person. You can get a table of eight for $500. And if you're wanting to make those purchases, you can call Stanislaus County Farm Bureau. The number here is 209-522-7278. Or visit our website, go to the events page, and you can actually purchase your tickets online. And, you know, I just feel like now more than ever, agriculture needs to have a voice and connections with leadership and those folks that are making, you know, legislative changes that impact us. And the more people we have kind of touting that Farm Bureau, that agricultural message, the better off we'll be. So if you have not engaged with Farm Bureau previously, this is a great first event to come to and get a feel of who we are and what we do.
Yeah, especially given the challenges that you've mentioned, coming together and maybe getting a more unified message or more understanding of the obstacles that farmers are facing, getting together like this maybe lends itself to possibly getting unified behind some actionable types of ideas.
Yeah, my kind of selling point, Brian, to folks when I'm asking them to join Farm Bureau, you know, often folks will say to me, well, I'm not a farmer. But if your job is dependent on production agriculture staying in this state, you need to be a member of Farm Bureau. So if that means you're a pest control advisor or an ag lending, you know, banker, your job is dependent on production agriculture staying here. You should be an ag member with Farm Bureau.
Yeah, and even going a step further, driving around some of the more rural communities around California, seeing, you know, small country stores and other small businesses that might not be directly related to agriculture at all, their customers, that community is deeply linked to the success of farming. So those small rural businesses have a shared interest in agriculture and, you know, just keeping those small local economies going.
Yep, I agree. You know, we are really blessed in this state with an amazing climate, mostly good access to water, you know, rich, fertile soils. And not only that, but just amazing growers who, you know, have this family farm legacy, who are also open to adopting new practices and technology. And I feel like it's something we should really be proud of. And we need to do a better job of communicating what it is that we're doing. And hence, you know, the communication role that I am blessed to do here.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, USDA recently issued a report looking at how global production of agricultural products has grown and developed, including the realm of sustainability. Rod Bain has details.
The transformation of agriculture production on a global scale over the past six decades has been significant. That is among the findings of a recent USDA report looking at world ag production and progression from 1961 to 2020.
What this report tries to do is look at broad trends in global agricultural production, resource use, and productivity, how productive those resources employed in agriculture have been,
and its impacts on long-term sustainability. According to USDA research economist Keith Fugley, one of the report authors. First, from a productivity side.
From 1961 all the way up to 2020, global agricultural output increased by about fourfold.
With gross value growing from $1.1 trillion with a T dollars in 1961 to $4.3 trillion by 2020. Also changed over that same time period, increased diversity of products.
So some of the traditional things like root and tuber crops, cereal grains, they're actually a smaller share of that total output today than they were in prior decades. What has grown are oil seeds, fruits and vegetables, non-ruminant livestock like poultry and pork, and then especially we've seen huge growth in farm-raised fish, or what we call aquaculture.
Land in global agriculture grew 8% during that six-decade time frame. But what Fugley found interesting was the primary location of this growth.
The location of where that output is coming from has really shifted from what we call in the report the global north. That's kind of the high-income countries of North America, Europe, and then Asia Pacific, like Japan and Australia. And it's shifted to the global south, Latin America, Africa, and the rest of Asia.
Irrigated area grew by over two times between 1961 and 2020, with water use in agriculture now accounting for 70% of total global freshwater withdrawals. As far as resource use,
agriculture has become more productive. It's reducing the use of those resources around the world. So we're getting a lot more output per unit of land, as well as per unit of labor, but also getting more efficient use of fertilizers. We're reducing the amount of resource of water per output, as well as greenhouse gas emissions per output.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, U.S. red meat continues to perform exceptionally internationally. United States Meat Export Federation's Joe Sheely reports.
February was another great month for U.S. pork exports, and while leading market Mexico was once again the pace setter, U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom said strong global demand for U.S. pork is widespread.
February export stats continue to show significant momentum for pork globally, up 10% year to date, 14% growth in the month of February. We continue to see a dramatic performance by Mexico, but I think this month the real story is that there's a lot of other markets that are contributing to the cause. We've got Korea, we've got Colombia, we've got Australia, Central America. Korea in particular is exciting, I think, because it's starting to show the inevitable rebound of food service in Korea, which we've been waiting on for several months. So I think overall, a very exciting month for pork.
February beef exports were down slightly from a year ago in volume, but jumped 10% in value. Western Hemisphere markets led the way, but Hallstrom also sees encouraging signs in the Middle East and in some Asian markets.
For February on beef, a very big month again for Mexico, almost 20,000 tons. But similar to pork, we're starting to see some other markets really contribute as well. Caribbean, I believe, had a record month, almost 3,000 tons, diversified across several different countries within the region. You had Central America with dramatic growth and South America as well. And I shouldn't leave out the Middle East, especially on the beef variety meats. And you know, you've got Asia stepping up on a beef side, over 5,000 tons for Taiwan, which is 15% growth after a slow start in January. February looks pretty good in Taiwan. And Korea, while down slightly on the volume side, the value side showed dramatic growth. So we're starting to see international tourism pick up in Asia, but it's especially apparent in the numbers for Korea.
For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm Joe Sheely.
In other livestock news, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at drought coverage for hay and cattle production areas per the April 2nd U.S. Drought Monitor.
Hay and cattle in drought, starting off with hay. Good news there as well. Should be a good year for hay production, generally speaking, across the United States. Yes, a few lingering drought pockets, but the broader picture is favorable. 14% of the U.S. hay production area in drought on April 2nd. That is down from 42% last October. And then for cattle in drought, just 13%. That also down from last October's peak of 47%. So I know we're still trying to recover the cattle inventory from multiple years of drought, but at least the current picture is favorable for starting to rebuild some of those cattle herd numbers that have been depleted over the recent drought years.
Earlier, we learned how pork is performing exceptionally well abroad, yet it's domestically that hog farmers are facing some challenges. Join me back tomorrow for more on that. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just want to get the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
California's Delta-Mendota Canal is set to undergo a transformative initiative with a $15 million investment to install solar panels. The project aims to cover the canal with solar arrays, offering a dual benefit of generating renewable energy while mitigating water loss through evaporation. Spearheaded by collaborations between the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and the University of California Merced, the project seeks to assess the viability, costs, and benefits of this approach. The project aims to validate floating voltaic design for moving water and address maintenance issues associated with panels on a canal. It also seeks to better understand the potential for power generation and quantify impacts on water quality. The project is part of similar efforts in Oregon and Utah that are being supported by a total investment of more than $19 million by the Department of Interior. The Global Coalition of Fresh Produce has launched its second global survey on the costs of fruit and vegetable production and trading. The effort is underway as a follow-up on the 2023 survey conducted during unprecedented cost hikes. The survey aims to understand how the situation has evolved over the past year, providing insights into production and trading costs across regions like the U.S., Canada, Europe, Africa, and more. The coalition emphasizes the importance of shedding light on challenges in the fresh produce supply chain globally to help the industry, its partners, and all government levels understand the current impacts of production and operating costs and hopefully work towards solutions to address them. The survey seeks participation from all industry members to aid in framing and understanding current challenges. Industry members interested in participating can find a link to the survey at agnetwest.com. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is making significant investment in the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. The program aims to support conservation and climate solutions through partner-driven projects. A total of $1.5 billion is being made available in fiscal year 2024. RCPP initiatives benefit farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners by promoting conservation strategies, saving costs, generating revenue, and enhancing productivity. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service will be accepting proposals through July 2nd. NRCS is simplifying program processes and implementation with an online portal and webinars to provide additional information for project proposals. NRCS is also implementing improvements to streamline RCPP agreements, reduce negotiation time, and enhance program efficiency, aiming for quicker processing of payments and supporting locally led projects. There are several preventative actions available to help avoid Ascochyta infections in garbanzo beans. Agronomy and Nutrient Management Advisor Nick Clark detailed some of the approaches available for growers.
There is seed treatment, so it's important to use fungicide seed treatment that's specific to preventing Ascochyta from developing disease, as it's also a seed-borne disease. It can come in on diseased seed. So fungicide seed treatment and also getting seed from a source that and verify that the seed is certified disease-free is important. Variety selection is going to be important. There are a number of varieties that are commonly grown in California, and in our latest publication, the Garbanzo Production Manual from the University of California, there's a table in there that describes the level of Ascochyta blight resistance, so people can look at that manual and learn which of the varieties we have that might help prevent developing disease.
The Western Landowner Alliance will be hosting a webinar focused on the Grassland Conservation Reserve Program in the coming weeks. Grassland CRP is a voluntary working lands program where the Farm Service Agency contracts with producers to protect grassland, including rangeland, pasture land, and wildlife habitat, while also maintaining the areas as grazing lands. A webinar to highlight details of the program is scheduled for Wednesday, April 24th. Panelists include FSA Farm Program Manager Patrick Lewis, NRCS National CSP Program Manager Katrina Thompson, Wyoming landowner and co-owner of the Ensign Group Chris Robinson, and California producer Matthew Stark. The webinar will go over the application process, how the program works, what's required of the landowner or producer, and other general program details. More information about the webinar is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Global food prices have dropped for the last 7 months, but that may be slowing down. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization's Food Price Index was 118.3 points in March, which is up 1.3 points from its revised February level. The rise in prices was driven by higher prices indices for vegetable oils, dairy products, and meat. That slightly more than offset decreases in those for sugar and cereals. Before the uptick in March following a 7-month-long decline, the index was down almost 10 points from the same time last year. The biggest rise was in the vegetable oil price index, which averaged 130.6 points in March, up 9.7 points from February, and reached its highest average in a year. The biggest drop was in the sugar price index, which averaged 133.1 points for March, down 7.6 points from February after two consecutive monthly increases. The best weed control is often prevention. Chad Smith has more.
Resistance is also beginning to develop in hard-to-control weeds like goosegrass, and growers' access to new modes of action is more limited than ever. Sean Lynch is the director of C-Pro Ag, a company that successfully expanded the label of its unique mode of action pre-emergence herbicide, Break. It's been used in cotton and was labeled for peanuts and rice. Lynch talks about challenges cotton growers face in weed control.
When you look back over the last 20 years, it was about in 2005, the first case of glyphosate-resistant pigweed hit the radar in our industry. And since then, it's not only just about resistant Palmer pigweed, it's now moving to documented cases of resistance with weeds like goosegrass, ragweed. Across the Mid-South and the Southeast, it's not just about pigweed anymore. The challenges are broadening themselves to other weed species. And when you couple that with the fact that there hasn't been a ton of innovation in herbicide technology over these last 20 years, growers are really looking for answers.
He talks about the advantages of a pre-emergence over a more common post-program.
It's really about what's going to give that grower the weed control control, you're going to need a good foundational pre-emergence herbicide program coupled with the right post-emergence products to give that grower the ultimate program he needs to manage those weeds. We recommend, number one, start clean. So what that means is a tank mix in cotton with a burn down herbicide, and then couple that with Brake plus another pre-emergence herbicide of choice. We want different modes of action going into the tank so that we prevent further resistance and we do a better job of controlling the resistant weeds that are out there.
Lynch talks about the reason why resistance is becoming a larger problem.
It goes back to the lack of innovation that unfortunately has not occurred with new and different modes of action, herbicides being available to have those different tools. It's becoming a larger problem because we're in many cases relying on older chemistry. What makes Brake really unique? We received label approval from the EPA where you can now use Brake in peanut as well as rice. You're bringing now a different mode of action to the table with Brake certainly in peanut and rice. And even in cotton, there's so much more acres that we believe we can provide value to growers on, especially in states from the coastal Carolinas on down through Georgia and Alabama.
He says it's important for farmers to lean on the professionals who bring value to their operations.
You're able to sit down with your trusted advisor, someone who will really take the time to understand what your needs are, take the time to take this integrated approach, meaning using post and pre-emergence products, using different modes of action. It's about how can we latch on to these valued advisors that will really help us sustain our farming operations for years to come.
For more information, go to ag.cpro.com/break. Chad Smith reporting.
Changing federal policy on milk production may still be a while, but it started moving this month. David Geiger has this report.
The U.S. Agriculture Department will now consider updates to the federal milk marketing order. The deadline for modernization briefs was April 1st. Stephen Kane, an economist with the National Milk Producers Federation, says there is a huge list of requested changes, and the post-hearing gave all interested parties a chance to speak.
To effectively summarize their arguments and give USDA kind of a concise document that outlines why they think the federal order should be amended this way or that way. So really what it was a summarization of what we've been working on for the last 6 months.
That means a close look at what is done with federal orders and making sure it's doing the best work it can for dairy producers. One primary issue is returning to the hire of Class 1 mover.
We made a change a few years ago. Turned out to not be the best decision there. So we're looking to return to the hire of mover, which worked for many years, many decades.
Costs have gone up in 20 years, the last time the order was updated. Other requests look at making sure the system and formulas within orders are reflective of current milk production.
We took a step back, look at the federal order system, and said, all right, great. These need to be updated, but we can't just update one piece over there that's just going to benefit one side of the industry. We took a holistic approach and updated changes that are beneficial for the entire industry.
Processor representatives have been at these hearings as well. Kane has disagreed with much of what those groups put forth. However, one of the areas they could agree on were adjustments needed to make sure there is enough investment in processing, which also has not been updated in decades.
The make allowances are really the big piece there. We're looking to make some adjustments there to move those up, make sure that we have a healthy processing industry as well as healthy dairy farmers.
The modernization ideas and suggestions will take a while before implementation. USDA recommendations will come in July with finalization at the end of the year. Most decisions won't take effect until quarter one of 2025. I'm David Geiger reporting.
The nation's hog producers are doing all they can to cope with some of the challenging market conditions. Gary Crawford has more.
Pork producers would like to be able to keep production under control to help boost hog prices or at least keep them from falling any more than they have already. But that effort is being sabotaged in a way by the efficient manner of hog production, namely
the big increase in the pigs per litter rate.
Agriculture Department livestock analyst Mike McConnell.
Yeah, that's, you know, we've seen the past couple reports is a big increase in the pigs per litter rate. And then that continued through the last quarter. between December and February.
During that quarter, the average pigs saved per litter was well over 11 and a half, and it was only about 11 pigs even during the same three-month period a year ago. And here is why this is so important. Taking a look at recent trends in the hog market, Mike McConnell says for farrow to finish operations the last year or so has not been the best. In fact,
returns have been negative and pretty largely negative over the past year, going, you know, for most of 2023.
To try and fix that, producers have been trying to reduce production or at least stabilize it by reducing farrowings. USDA's latest Hogs and Pigs report says that during the December through February quarter, producers farrowed almost 2.9 million head, a 3% reduction from the same quarter a year ago. And the USDA report also carries information on what producers intend to farrow. And they tell USDA that for the March through May quarter, they will cut farrowings by 1% from a year earlier. And for the June through August quarter, the cut will be 2%. All of this designed to curb pork output.
However, the improvements that they're getting on the pigs per litter rate and the productivity out of their sows is surpassing that. And as a result, we still have a bigger pig crop despite the lower farrowings.
The pig crop at last count was still running 2% larger than 1 year ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's an excerpt from an episode of the Voices of the Valley podcast, highlighting the nature of bees and how they contribute to agriculture.
Hi, my name is Kara Timmons. I am the communications manager from Western Growers. Welcome to Voices of the Valley.
And I'm Gina Cadby. I'm the environment and climate director for Western Growers.
Today, we have Katie Chiapuzio. She is the director of environmental sciences and resources at Braga Fresh. And while Katie has a lot on her plate, today we are specifically talking about bees.
Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Braga and what you folks produce?
Sure, yeah. Braga Fresh is a cool season veg producer out of the Salinas Valley. We've been farming for about 95 years now, starting in dairy cattle and then moving as the Salinas Valley shifted, and now we're doing 38 commodities of cool season vegetables. We grow in the Salinas Valley as well as the Imperial Valley, and we have been kind of leading the charge in this area on sustainability initiatives. So we're really big on integrating any sort of sustainability initiative and biodiversity into our farms to allow us to rely less on inputs and more on the, you know, native biodiversity that exists in the area. So one of the ways in which we do that is by implementing all of this habitat on our farm. So we have several acres of permanent habitat as well as habitat on our borders and an apiary.
So how did bees find their way onto Braga Farms? Because bees are not native to the area. So how did that happen?
Yeah, so when I was hired with Braga about 4 years ago, I had a history in apiculture, and it was something that I didn't really want to leave behind. And so when I was offered the role that I have now, I was told that I could actually bring my bees with me. And so I started with about four hives on our home ranch, and as I started to bring them over to our seed crops that we were pollinating and really start to use them in the operation, they gave me the permission to add more. And so now we have upward of 15 hives that we move around our different ranches as we're pollinating our seed crops and establishing our beneficial habitats. And that's kind of, it was a package deal. They came with me.
BYOB, I love that.
What do bees do for agriculture, and how important are bees to our agriculture system?
Yeah, so it really depends the agricultural system that you are referring to. So obviously, if we have things like tree crops, almonds, citrus, bees are directly pollinating those crops. And so I think that industry, the value of bees in the pollination industry in the U.S. is about $15 billion worth of crops that are pollinated by bees. If you're talking about things like cool season veg, like we grow in the Salinas Valley, bees are pollinating our habitats, they're pollinating our seed crops, but they're not directly pollinating our cash crops.
How do organizations like Braga in the push towards sustainability integrate bees into this plan and this system?
Yeah, so at Braga, we actually manage an apiary on site. So I manage about 18 hives of honeybees on our home ranch and some of our other ranches in the Salinas Valley. So the reason that we do that is because we have ample habitat in our ranches, and we need to keep that habitat blooming year-round. And so we use our bees as supplemental pollination for this habitat that's then going to support beneficial insects into our crops. We also try to integrate native habitat so that we can get native bees and native pollinators also thriving in our area. When you have a really fragmented landscape, such as the Salinas Valley, where you have all of these monocrops all around the valley, you've taken away a lot of habitat. But we want to integrate that and reintegrate that into the valley so that these pollinators that existed here once can stay here.
So what does it mean to have a healthy bee? What does a healthy bee look like?
Oh, geez. a healthy bee is flying alive, generally. No, I would say, so it's more about a healthy colony than it is about a healthy individual bee. So bees are actually seen as superorganisms. So as opposed to looking at even one box of bees, you want to be looking at your entire apiary and managing the health just like you would with a crop field. You're not going to manage for one plant, you're going to manage for your entire field, right? And so for me, I guess the indicators that I look for is activity. You want to make sure that your hives are moving on warm days. You want to see a lot of activity. You want to see bees coming in with pollen on their legs. They're all dancing into the hive. You don't want to see any sort of like physical ailments. So sometimes you'll see a bee with disease and it'll have wings that are, you know, not formed all the way, or it'll be moving really slowly. And so it's really about just looking at your hive as a whole and making sure that you're not seeing anything crazy. You don't want to see any mold or any sort of weird behaviors.
You mentioned dancing bees. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So bees have a very kind of cool way that they communicate with one another. One of those ways is this little dance. It's like a little figure eight that they do. And what they're doing when they're doing this figure eight is they're indicating what direction other bees should fly and what they're looking for. So generally, if a bee, let's say, chooses a California poppy and sees a really good patch of California poppies that has a lot of pollen, nectar, and resources that they need, what they'll do is they'll bring back a little bit of that pollen so that the other bees can smell it. And then they'll indicate with this little dance which direction the bees should fly in to go get that resource. So as a colony, they're going to come back and say, okay, this was a really good resource, let's all go there. And then when they, you know, take all the pollen and nectar from that, they'll find a different resource and they'll all focus on that. So it's this really effective way to get the whole group, you know, taking the same resources and then moving around. Whereas if you find a flower that isn't producing a lot of pollen, they're not going to indicate that you should go in that direction.
Are there other examples of high level of communication between the hive?
Yeah, absolutely. So bees mostly communicate through pheromones. And so people often ask, why are bees swarming in the spring? And the reason the bees are swarming in the spring is because the pheromones indicated that they should be leaving. And so swarming is actually like a reproductive activity that they do. And the reason that they do it is the queen is in the colony. It's getting really, really crowded. She can't really control the hive as she could before. And so her pheromones are not distributing the way that she wants them to. And she starts to get ready to leave. And so the worker bees will then start to create princess bees. So they'll usually do 10 or 15 cells that they're turning into princess bees. And then once those princess bees are capped and starting to pupate, about half the colony will actually leave with the queen to go find a new place. And then when they're out, obviously her pheromones need to be, you know, communicating in open air. And so she has these really strong pheromones. She's keeping all of these bees really tight together. And then she's sending scout bees out to find a new place to live so that they can develop their new colony. And so they're actually splitting their population and expanding their colonies. Like I said, they're a superorganism. So instead of, you know, like reproducing, they're actually fully creating new families.
That once again was the Voices of the Valley podcast. You are listening to the Agnet News Hour. Now for more news. April 1st end date for the Western water season has come and gone, but what does that mean for the regional water supplies in 2024? Rod Bain looks into it.
Recent storminess has been quite impressive in places like the Great Basin and the Four Corner States, and that has left snowpack greater than 150% of average in terms of that water equivalency in much of the Great Basin, as well as southern Utah, much of Arizona, and New Mexico. So that's really good news because there are only two states in the western U.S. that have below average reservoir storage. One of those is New Mexico. The other is Washington State. Well, that above average snowpack in New Mexico will certainly help. It won't fill reservoirs, but it should improve low reservoir levels in that state. Also, good benefit for the reservoirs and for the water supply pretty much throughout the Southwest, the Great Basin, and much of the Intermountain West, in addition to California and the Sierra Nevada.
With the latest Western water season now concluded, what is the outlook for water supplies going into the spring and summer? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
For the most part, it is actually a pretty good picture again this year. And in fact, if you would draw a line from Oregon to western and southern Wyoming, everyone south of that line is reporting above average snowpack.
That translates to favorable water storage for most of the region. What area of concern?
That is that northern tier of the West, extending across from the northern Cascades to the northern Rockies. We see snowpack water equivalencies that are less than 75% of average.
With Washington State already reporting below average water storage supplies. Another long-term concern, below average water storage in the Colorado River Basin. That despite back-to-back years of positive snowpack. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey gives us more details on storage levels of western water reservoirs going into the spring and summer months.
What we're looking at with the reservoir situation, we're still benefiting from the 2022-23 winter, and also we expect to benefit in the southern two-thirds of the West from a pretty abundant 2023-2024 winter. And so we should see reservoirs filling back up nicely across much of that southern two-thirds of the western United States. That'll help with the low reservoir levels in New Mexico. But we do have those concerns in the north, especially Washington State, where we do have that below average storage. Now, as we move into the California situation, the latest reservoir numbers coming in from California showing that we have storage roughly 120% of average. If you look at the 154 primary intrastate reservoirs, and that's about three quarters of capacity. So we're looking really good there. And that gives us a little bit of a buffer in case we go into a drier year next fall and winter. And certainly a pretty good situation after two favorable years for most of the key watersheds in California. Now, as we move to the north, there are a few problems. That's really the only trouble spot for western water supply broadly across all of Washington State, most of Montana, northern Idaho, and northeastern Wyoming. And so that is the area of concern. Given the low reservoir storage in Washington State, that is a concern that there will be below average runoff. We already have below average storage, so there could be some water supply concerns, for example, in the Columbia River Basin in the northwest. But other than that, a pretty rosy water supply picture, except across that northern tier of the western U.S. The Sierra Nevada, which supplies a great deal of the water that goes into both municipal and agricultural use in northern and central California. The California Department of Water Resources is indicating that as of April 1st, that snowpack contains an average of 29 inches of liquid equivalency. That is 110% of the historic average for the date, and that means that for the second consecutive year, there is a favorable snowpack. This comes off the record-setting 2022-23 year when we finished the season with about 62 inches of water equivalency in that snowpack. That means that for the most part, California's key reservoirs in the northern and central part of the state should fill back up nicely as the snow melts. And it does portend a pretty good season for water supply as that water runs into the rivers and the canals that serve key agricultural areas such as the San Joaquin Valley in central California.
That again, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.